Will you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Our speaker is being recorded tonight with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Ralph from Lake Forest.
My name is Ralph Bowen, and I'm an alcoholic. And I see some faces saying, where do I know this guy from? If you've ever come out of a blackout in the local emergency room with a security officer in a blue uniform and a badge standing over you that you tried to bite or spit at or something, that was me. My sobriety date is the 26th of July, 1971. In about 25 days, I hope to make 41 years. And I'm actively sponsored. Alice is my sponsor. I sponsor Jim, who spoke here a few weeks ago. And Jim sponsors Paul, who's leading the meeting tonight. And we go down even further than that. Most meetings we go to are potlucks, conventions, or whatever. We have six, seven, eight generations of sponsorship at one, you know, at breakfast or something like that. And I see some young faces here. I get sober at age 30. And I get into some vital statistics. I was raised in Boston. I'm the youngest of 11 kids. Alcoholism is all through my family. My family is kind of like the Irish families. They're either in AA or they need to be in AA. And the middle sister and the middle brother died of this thing. And I remember as a small boy, I had three uncles used to come around, and they were always drunk. And my father had a pickup truck because he was a carpenter. And he didn't want his drunken uncles in around the kids, so he'd tell them, you stay in the truck tonight, you can come in the house tomorrow. And a lot of that stuff never made sense till I got sober and I started doing Al-Anon. I have 37 years in Al-Anon. But being the kid, you know, I had to give up my bed or sleep on the couch or sleep on the floor. And my one uncle would get to coughing in the middle of the night. And he'd say, "Till later, I need my cough syrup." You know, Edda was my mother. And I'd go knocking on the door. "Uncle so-and-so wants his cough syrup." And my mother would get up, get the bottle where they hid it, give him a shot. He'd stop coughing and go back to sleep. My parents would go back to sleep, and I'd go back to sleep. And that never made any sense to me until I started getting sober myself years later, you know, and in Al-Anon. I had, you know, three uncles like that, a dynamite blaster, a steel walker. And I recently, like I say, it's all through my family. I have about 30 nieces and nephews, and they're showing up in these rooms, and they're growing up, and their kids are showing up in these rooms. And I recently found out I got another sister. And I called her in Florida, you know, and she was told a bunch of garbage about her brothers and sisters that wasn't true. And I told her, "Your brothers and sisters are wonderful people." I said, "But I got to ask you a very personal question. Have you ever had a problem with alcohol or drugs?" And she said, "No, but I knew as a young lady that if I ever got started, I wouldn't be able to stop." But she said, "My daughter does, and my son does." So there's a, you know, definite genetic component to this thing. And so I was, raised a French Catholic back in Boston. Had the nuns for 8 years. And went to vocational high school. And I really don't know when my first drink was. When you have, you know, five sisters and that, there's always big-bellied ladies and weddings, christenings, something going on. And I can remember as a kid, you know, them giving me beer and going, "More, more, more," you know. And one of my earliest recollections was at some kind of a reception and open chairs like this. And they had these little bottles. I don't even know if they make them anymore. They're just only about that big. I was probably 9, 10 years old. And I was stacking them under the chair. I had six or seven of them. My brothers and sisters were walking by. And they're going, "What are you doing?" And I said, "They might run out." 10 years old, I get to you people at age 30, and I found out that the one hallmark of alcoholism is denial. You know, not me, the lady next door, the guy down the street. And the second one is guarding the source of supply. And that's what I was doing as a 10-year-old kid. They might run out. And so, you know, if I see some young faces here, and you find out if you're an alcoholic or not. She might have the 20 questions over here. And you know, because your life depends on this thing. You know, if you're an alcoholic, do this thing like your life depends on it, because it does. And I'll ask you a simple question. Would you drink 7 or 8 glasses of water getting ready to go to a party where there was going to be free water all night long? You know? And that's what I do with alcohol. You know, and I saw some people waving court cards around. You know, if you're not an alcoholic and you get a drunk driving, your brain's going to say, "I didn't like jail, scared the hell out of me. I don't like sleeping on concrete with my shoe for a pillow. I had to give that lawyer all my money. I ain't driving drunk anymore." And if you're an alcoholic like me, your brain's going to say, "Why did I take the Coast Highway?" And that's because I can never associate what's happening to me. I can't tie it to alcohol. Because you're going to tell me to stop. And I can't stop. So now I got to start sneaking drinks and hiding drinks. So I went, I made it through vocational high school. Drinking, but it wasn't really interfering. And I went to work for Woolworths, F.W. Woolworths, 5 and 10 cent stores. I worked for them all through high school. And when I graduated, one day I was Ralph the stock boy. The next day I was in coat and tie and assistant manager. And they were required to call me Mr. Doyle. And I ended up in Connecticut. And it was quite a shock down there, but it was fun because it's right near the border of New York, and you can drink in New York at 18. And so, you know, I was still able to do a day's work and go over to New York and drink, till 2 or 3 in the morning. But my number was coming up in Massachusetts, coming up on the draft. I was number 3, heading for number 2. And all 5 of my brothers had been in the military, so I decided to join the Navy to get a better job and get some training or something. And so I joined the Navy, and I made it through boot camp, kind of 2 left feet. And I went to Great Lakes, Illinois for a boot camp. And they give you these dummy orders. They may or may not be your orders, permanent. But anyway, mine said, "Hospital Coleman." And I go, "What the hell is this?" So I asked somebody, and nobody knew. And finally, this chief said, "Yeah, you work in a hospital. You take care of sick people. Can you do that?" He said, "Do you mind this blood?" And I said, "Somebody else's, it doesn't bother me. But if it's my own, it kind of bothers me." So they said, "You're going to be a hospital Coleman." Well, my oldest brother did 20 years in the Navy and retired before I even went in, and I did 20 years and retired. And they said, "Well, if you don't like those orders and you don't want to be a corpsman, go down to this drill hall." And so I go down there and way up in the top of this drill hall, talking to this chief. And he knew my brother. And I thought, "Ooh, I'm going to get these orders changed." And I could not convince that man that Joey DeVoe was my brother and not my father. And boot camp, you know, you're scared about everything. So I just stopped trying to convince the guy. I just wanted them damn orders changed. I wanted to be a communication technician. So anyway, we go running around with this guy, and he said, "No, your orders are not going to be changed. All the corpsmen were getting killed in Vietnam. They needed hospital corpsmen." So anyway, I finished boot camp, and I went on a ship in Norfolk, waiting for my class to convene again at Great Lakes for hospital corps school. And it was nice for a young man, you know, in Norfolk, and drinking beer on the strip and listening to Patsy Cline and all that stuff. You know, even though I'm from Boston, I really liked country and western music. I still do, even after I got sober. And so I had a couple of near scrapes. You see, in the Navy, you can pretty much goof off during the day, but you have to be there in the morning for quarters. You have to be standing tall. And so I was able to show there, get up in the morning and show up for work, and then later on in the day I'd be hiding somewhere in the ship, you know, trying to sleep or get well, so that I could go do it again, you know, as soon as Liberty Call went down. And it started was starting to become a daily thing. And so it was time for me to go to Great Lakes for my hospital core school class. And I was the only one there in my whole class that was 21 years old. And Great Lakes was 21, and they have what they call a dram shaft act. You have to be 21 just to walk into a bar. If you walk into a bar and you're not 21, that constitutes drinking as a minor. And so, you know, we did a lot of drinking there. I used to walk, go out the base and go down through North Chicago, down into Waukegan, Milwaukee. Old Milwaukee beer, 25 cent a port. And I'm just now starting to see that stuff out here. But I'm going to school trying to learn this pharmacy math and remember all these drugs and doing all this stuff, and I'm drinking every day. And I'm hiding my booze in those white barracks, under the steps of the barracks. And I went to class one day, and a kid came into class. He said, "They got your stash." And I go, "What are you talking about?" "Well, every day they inspect. You have to clean the barracks and shine the brass deck drains and all that stuff." Well, the inspector come along and he saw a footprint on the toilet. And he took the clipboard from the... He said, "See what's up there." The flush box was up. And they climbed up there and they got my six-pack and my bottle of whiskey in hospital core school. And, I mean, that was... It was really... my drinking was escalating. And I would be... I knew if I went over Mainside, you know, with the dance and the club and all that, I wouldn't be able to get back to where the hospital and the thing was. So there was no club. So I would be drinking in the cafeteria of the hospital, this big concrete hospital, with my books spread out, studying this math. And people would be coming through there, visiting their loved ones in the hospital. And they go, psh, psh, psh. I didn't care. I had to drink. So anyway, I moved to finish hospital core school. And I'm just... I'm pretty sure, you know, I'm going to go to Vietnam and I'm going to get killed like all the other corpsmen. And so I hang around, wait around, and I did my first hitch at the Naval Hospital at Boston. And I've worked pediatrics, little two-pounders in my hand and Siamese twins and all that stuff. And I would do that for 8 to 9 hours, and then I'd be down downtown Boston drinking with the old retired Marines. They had what they call the horse blanket. It was a Marine Corps issue, long woolen coat. And these guys, they live from monthly check to monthly check. That was their wardrobe, their bathroom, their whatever. And, you know, it's snowing cold. And that's who I would be doing shots with. So when I decided to re-enlist, I asked for the West Coast, figuring I'm going to Vietnam for sure this time. And my orders come in, and I got submarine base dispensary, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, where the submarines tie in. And that's where I spent the next 3 years. And my drinking, whew, just shot out of sight. I ran a pharmacy there for about a year. I would get off at 3, go to the club, close the club up at 11, go down to the Don Ho show, usually the midnight show. That's when he was the dirtiest. And then after that, on Kapi'olani Boulevard, there's a big office building, but the first floor was a noodle factory. And you go through the noodle factory, and then the back was the after-hours joint. And I would come back to the base like 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, take a shower. You know, I'd lay down. We had about 8 beds. I'd lay down. The night guy would wake me up. I'd take a shower, and I'd go to work. And to my knowledge, I never misfilled a script or anything. But it was escalating and escalating. They gave me a going-away party when it was time to come to the States, and I missed my flight. I missed my flight at Hickam Air Force Base. When you have that medical caduceus on your left arm, you can get away with a lot of stuff. And they scooped me up and they took me down to Honolulu International. And they put me on a flight to back to San Francisco from there. I could have gotten a lot of trouble over that. But again, the drinking is really... When I first went to Hawaii, it was surfing, snorkeling, you know, all the things you do. But as the months went by, it was more and more the drinking and less of that. So if you knew or fairly knew some of you young people, that's the fun part of getting sober. I do the things I used to sit on the bar stool and talk about. Someday I'm going to fill in the blank. I used to do that. Yeah, I used to do that. But I couldn't get off the bar stool and do that stuff anymore. So that's what they mean by freedom from bondage. If you get sober, you can do these. You can do these things and enjoy life. And I finally went to, my orders came in and I finally went to Vietnam. And they send us these people-to-people thing, you know, toothpaste and like that. Well, those people didn't even brush their teeth. They didn't know what toothpaste was. And they sent me these big decanters of Listerine. And I was going out in the bush. And I poured out that Listerine and I filled it full of 190 alcohol, the stuff that we make cough syrup out of. I was taking straight shots of 190 alcohol. That can kill you. But that's what I took out in the boonies with me, along with my first aid supplies. Okay, and anyway, I made it through Vietnam. I did not get killed. They tried. They tried very hard, and they came very close many times. And I made it through the first tour and came back to the States. And then because I was, now I'm 85, they were sending 200 men back into Vietnam. The main body was going to Okinawa. So they said, oh, you're going with them. We want somebody of a little senior in rank to go with these guys and try to keep them alive. And so we're out in the boonies, out in the middle of nowhere. And I got to have a refrigerator for my vaccine. So up here is a refrigerator and a string of wire. We're out in the middle of nowhere. And I got a generator and a refrigerator to keep my beer closed. You know, that's what I'm saying. When you have that medical caduceus on your left arm, you get away with a lot of stuff. But all these guys wanted to do was come by and have a cold beer once in a while. And I was riding convoys every day through Ambush Row. And I would go with the expediter. And one club way up in Fubai was open for a couple hours in the morning for the night crew. And he would drop me off there. He'd make the rounds, pick up the mail, the spare parts and all that. He'd pull up in front of the club, toot the horn, and I'd go get in it. And we'd go back through Ambush Road almost daily. And it was quite an experience. I was 30 years old. 28, I guess. 28. Most of the guys, 17, 18. They started doing 120 rockets. You can hear them whistle from 8 miles. Eight miles out. They're about that big around and that tall. You can hear them coming in. And mortars. And they say, hit the holes. And I jump down in this hole. And I look over. And there's two, like, they look like 16-year-olds. They were kids from headquarters company. And I thought, these people are trying to kill us. They're trying to kill these kids. It was the first realization that I was in the middle of a war. And they were trying... This was real. There was no more drill or practice. They were trying to kill us. And so I managed to stay out of trouble through Vietnam. And we came back. I came back from the second tour. And I had always wanted independent duty school. Independent duty school is where you go on a small ship or you go on the field with the Marines. I had already been doing that. But you have advanced training. Because there's no doctor. And I'm going to this school down in San Diego, right across from Balboa Park, and I can't stop drinking. And they said vague things like, they have meetings up in that building and stuff like that. And I just couldn't stop drinking, and I wasn't interested. And I washed out of that school, a school I had waited like 12 years to get into. And they went back through the records to see if anybody ever flunked out of that school. And there was one man... And it wasn't his fault. He had a family issue, and he couldn't go to school. His wife was sick or something, and he had to drop out of that school. So that was really, that was not good for me. It was not good for morale. And so after I washed out of that school, they sent me to Camp Pendleton. And now I'm 30 years old, and paint a little picture for you. I'm 30 years old. I'm skinny. I got nosebleeds, I'm bleeding from my esophagus, you can see my liver from across the room, and I'm in the medical doctor's office, and he's got the paper of the blood that he drew, and he said, look at these numbers, you know what this means, you're dying, you need to stop drinking. And I couldn't wait to get out of his office and go about my drinking. And because I had this pending court-martial over my drinking, they made me go by and talk to the chaplain. And basically the chaplain said, "Devoe, you keep drinking, you're going to go to hell." Couldn't wait to get out of his office and go about my drinking. After all, he scared me, you know. And then the Navy psychiatrist said, "Devoe, you keep drinking, you're going to go crazy." And I was locked in his locked psychiatric ward across from Balboa Park the day he told me that. So the Navy sent me to treatment. Treatment sent me to you people. And a butcher and a truck driver and an auto mechanic taught me how not to drink. They did not have four stripes in their sleeve. They did not have a lot of initials after their name. But they were alcoholics, and for some reason I was willing to listen to them. A guy that ran around the world selling cash registers, lived in Oceanside, took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so my shore duty, my court martial started at 8 o'clock in the morning. I was up at 7, squaring away my uniform, shining my shoes, and drinking a beer to go to my court martial over drinking. The chief had a heart attack and quit drinking. And he had a separate checkbook just for gambling. He would throw the keys up in the rafters and bet whether they'd stay up there. And the JG was a little Southern Baptist, looked like a Bucky Beer and chewed seeds all the time. And the commander I worked for in charge of medical supply was a Southern Baptist. And the CEO of the hospital was a Southern Baptist. So that's why when my friend said, "They're railroading and they're picking on them," you know, we all believe that. But anyway, when I went through the process of the steps, I had to go back to all four of them men and, you know, and make my amends. Because I'm sitting there in my court martial with my legal pad, and I got to cross-examine them men. And all four of them men said they didn't realize they had an alcoholic and his right to drink challenged, backed against the wall. All four of them men said they'd never write up another sailor as long as they're in the Navy. Because I made them look ridiculous. Not that I'm brilliant. I'm just a drunk who was trying to protect his right to drink. So they said, they confused me. They said, "You drink too much, and we're sending you to treatment." And they knew the shape I was in, I couldn't get from Camp Pendleton to Long Beach, California on my own. So they sent me up there in a black Navy sedan with my own driver. And I knew this guy because I drove ambulances and security vehicles. And we get up to Long Beach, and just before we crossed the bridge, I said, "Two beers, promise you, two beers." I went in and I, you know, drank one beer. Didn't even finish the second one. Went out and got in the vehicle. We crossed the bridge, and I'm checking in for rehab. I thought that was going to be my last drink. If you talk to some of these people that old, you know, that have been around here a while, most of us did not know our last drink was going to be our last drink. We got heavy, heavy whiskey drinker. Their last drink was some foo-foo thing with an umbrella. We got people who are heavy drinkers here. Their last drink was Listerine or some stupid thing like that. Most of us did not know our last drink was going to be our last drink. And so I had to check in on the hospital ship, and my drinking buddy from San Diego was doing his thing with the typewriter, and we chit-chatted, and he did what he had to do, and I turned to go over the barracks, and I go to walk off the hospital ship, and I look down, and I got this wristband with my name and the words "chronic alcoholism," and I go, "God damn, how dare they, you know?" I got so flustered, I forgot to salute the ensign watching off the ship. So I go over there to the barracks. I'm with about 40 guys. This is before it was up in the hospital. This was out on Terminal Island. The hospital wouldn't even admit it was there, that it was part of the hospital. That's the same place Betty Ford got sober years later. And they sent Billy Carter there, but of course he went back to selling his Billy beer. But I said, "Well, you know, you guys, you ought to quit. You know, save that pension. You know, because you guys, he's 6, 7, 8, 9, you're ready to retire. Save that pension. You know, I'd quit too if I was you, but I'm only 30 years old. I can't dance. I can't drive. I can't do anything without alcohol, including keep down solid food. I had to introduce alcohol before I could eat solid food. I got 10 years in the Navy done, 10 years to do, and my life is over because you're telling me I can't drink anymore." And they confused me because they said, "You drink too much. And so we're sending you to treatment." And I, you know, like I say, treatment sent me to them, and they sent me to you. And I found out here, people like us don't drink too much. We can't drink enough. That's our problem. We can't drink enough. I never said on a Sunday night, well, 6 o'clock, you know, tomorrow's a work day. I think I'll knock this off. No, no. I closed up the club, maybe went to town. And we didn't have 12 packs at once, so I'd be juggling 3 6 packs back to the barracks to get me through the night and the next day. I never said, I've had enough. And so I go through the process of a treatment, and I'm convinced, you know, I know I'm alcoholic. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm doing this program, everything you do, watching movies, doing the role playing. And my sister lived in Garden Grove and come down and get me on the weekends and take me over to her house. And I was hanging around the Garden Grove Club. That's where I took my 30-day chip. And I thought, I'm getting bored with these people. I'm getting bored with these old-timers. They're pretty smart, you know. And but I saw a sign on the boulevard that there was going to be country and western music. And I went there, walked up there on a weekend night. I'm not even sure what it was. And I sat down at the bar with a Coke, listening to the country. And these three young ladies come in and sat here. And I don't dance. I don't do anything without booze. But I want to dance. I want to talk to these ladies. So I had the bartender take the Coke away and give me an Olympia beer, just for looks. Just for looks. And I drank that. And I put it back down on the bar. And I fell down. And I was perspiration from here to here. And I get up and I brushed myself off. And I fell down again. And I get up, and I'm trying to hide this wristband that's got my name and the words chronic alcoholism. And I tell the bartender, yeah, I'm taking some medicine. I probably shouldn't have drank that. If you're not familiar with antabuse, it's not an up or down, or it does nothing. It just lies there. If you introduce alcohol, you can have a violent reaction. You can die. We have lovely Al-Anon wives who think they're helping their husband by dropping that stuff in his coffee or something. Don't do that. You can kill people. So I said, can you call me a cab? And he said, where are you? I said, no, it's down the street here. It's called Healy Street. I'm staying with my sister. This guy had somebody else watch his bar, and he gave me a ride to my sister's. So if you ever hear this recording, I'm in debt to you, the fellow that owned that bar. I walk in my sister's house. Of course, I'm all flushed, red. My mother's out here. She's in her 80s. She's had a lot of problems with her sons and daughters with, you know, booze and stuff. She's so proud her youngest is getting sober. And I got to walk past her and my sister and all that. And I go in the back bedroom and lay down. My sister knew something was wrong. She came in. And I made the mistake of putting her hand on my chest. And my heart was beating out of my chest. And she wanted to call the paramedics. And I said, no, I just need to go to sleep. And I went off to sleep. This sister, she got Al-Anon without doing Al-Anon. She was grossly overweight. She had trophies all around her house from gaining weight, you know, losing weight, gaining weight. We never talked about her overweight problem, and we never talked about my drinking problem. 6 o'clock in the morning, she'd be making me bacon and eggs, and I'd be drinking beer, and she never said anything. You know, she knew it wouldn't help. So anyway, I get up the next morning, everybody's still asleep. I made a pot of coffee, and I'm sitting in her kitchen, and I watch my language at the podium, but I'm just me talking to me, sitting in her kitchen, and I said, You know you're alcoholic, and you're in this treatment thing, and you went up there and drank, just like you knew what you were doing. You only got two choices. You're awful goddamn stupid, or you're an alcoholic. And I've never had to go back in almost 41 years and make that decision again. You know, the thought crossed my mind, like all alcoholics, this time it's going to be different. I can handle that drink, you know, that's not going to happen. But I've never had to go back making that decision again. So I finished treatment, and I didn't want to go back to Camp Pendleton because they knew, you know, the hospital at Camp Pendleton, because they knew I drank. Through the process of treatment, I knew my chances of staying sober were better if I did go right back there. Something in treatment clicked. So I went back to Camp Pendleton. I have in my house somewhere the paper. At that time, the only person in that hospital that could use a red pen was the CO of the hospital, because you couldn't photocopy it in the medical records. And he had written on the message I was coming back, place this man in the psychiatric clinic so we can avail ourselves of his talents. So I'm in the psychiatric clinic with 8 psychiatrists. It's fun. I'm filing records. I'm doing testing. And these guys are trippy. They come in the morning and say, good morning. And the other one goes, what do you mean by that? You know? It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun working with those guys, but they did not want nothing to do with drunks. They wanted to practice psychiatry. Well, the chief of medicine took an interest in alcoholics, and we got a wing, and we started a treatment center at the hospital at Camp Pendleton. My show duty was up. I had to move on. I ended up on Hawaii, and I was on a ship, and I got a new doctor on board, and it had been like a year and a half, 2 years since I drank, and I had the medical records office, and one morning he saw me spill my coffee, and I had a dish of hard candy on my desk, and the other corpsman would reach over my shoulder and take my candy, and you know, when the ship goes, there's no place to get more hard candy, and I would, you know, well, he picked up on those. Sharp. He picked up on that. He said, "How long have you been shaking like that?" I said, "Oh, it comes and goes." I had already broken my anonymity to him. He said, "I don't think so. Don't eat until I come aboard in the morning. I'm going to do a blood test on you." And he did. My sugars were going to 60 and 50. Now, all alcoholics have blood sugar, low blood sugar. But when it tends to come back, that's why in the book it says to eat chocolate and stuff like that. It tends to come back with time. Mine was not coming back. And so he put me off in Hawaii. And I had my tape recorder, my toolbox, and I'm standing on the pier at Hawaii, and my ship's leaving for Australia. I didn't get to see Australia. So I'm over in the medical transit barracks, and I go see the dietitian up at the Army Hospital, and she's teaching me how to eat. It's the opposite of diabetes. And a diabetic doesn't secrete enough insulin, so they have to inject. Somebody like hypo, the pancreas secretes too much insulin, and insulin burns sugar. So the first thing you got to do is stop sugar. I haven't had white sugar in 40 years. I eat stuff with sugar in it. It's the white granulated sugar that's bad. And so I'm in the Merrick's, in the medical holding company out on Ford Island, and I'm having sessions with the dietitian, and she's teaching me how to eat. She's teaching me tricks like when you make a sandwich, take the edge of the bread and throw it away or feed it to the birds. Just keep enough bread to hold your sandwich together for the low carb, you know. And I'm riding across the boat. She told me to drink Tab. When this happened, there was no pink packet, blue packet, and all that stuff. And the one diet drink was Tab. So I got a case of hot Tab under my bunk in the transit barracks, and I'm drinking hot Tab all day long, and I'm riding the boat across Pearl Harbor to go up and see the dietitian, and I want to jump out of the goddamn boat in the middle of Pearl Harbor. So what's wrong with me? She didn't tell me Tab was loaded with caffeine. It's about twice of a cup of coffee. You know, and like many alcoholics, I was caffeine susceptible. So I had a lot of sessions with her, and it really helped. But they were starting a treatment center. And so I talked them into, like I say, when you got that medical caduceus on your left arm, you know, you can pull some stuff. And I got them to move me from Fort Island over to where they were going to put this treatment center. And the two counselors that were stationed there, and I was working with them. To make a long story short, right there at the main gate of Pearl Harbor, up over security, we built a treatment center that held about 35, 40 guys. You know, sailors and Marines and that. And then, because I was in transit there, I did not have a vehicle. I would be on the phone calling you. I got three. I got two. In other words, meet me at the main gate. I got three newcomers. I got two newcomers. I need to get them to a meeting. And that's how I operated right from the outset. I stayed active in AA, and I stayed active in the military treatment program. My time was up there, and I got stationed with an aviation squadron up in Lemoore in the San Joaquin Valley. We flew off of the Enterprise. I built a treatment center up there that held 14 people, and I was still standing my watches in the emergency room. It took my squadron CO convincing the CO of the base to tell the CO of the hospital, "You're killing this guy." Because they're getting correspondence, letters, and phone calls from all over the damn world for Ralph. Everybody wants to know, who is this Ralph guy? You know? And I got called into the CO of the hospital. He said, "You don't have to stand your watches anymore in the emergency room. I understand the kind of work that you're doing with these alcoholics, and I want you to stay and do that full time." And so that's what I was doing. And one of those big conglomerate farmers, you know, the multi-million-dollar farms, he was one of us. And the CEO would say, "Did you see Sam at the meeting?" And I'd say, "Sir, you know I can't tell you who I see at those meetings." But anyway, that's how I stayed involved. And so I'm doing this treatment thing, and I'm feeling like a dish rag. I'm depressed, I'm crying, I don't know what the hell. Why am I weak all the time, no energy and whatever? And so I go to the doctors and they're doing all these kind of tests. The point I'm trying to make for you newcomers, if you think something's wrong, go see a doctor and get it checked out. If nothing's wrong, then it's here. Right? So I go see the doctor and they're doing these tests. And finally one doctor says, it's like three doctors. Finally one says, let's check him for valley fever. It's a skin test, like a TB test. I had caught San Joaquin Valley fever up there. It's spores in the dirt when the farmers plow and make dust and you breathe it. It gets in your lungs. And so they said, yeah, valley fever. They said, you know, in the old days we used to prescribe a sea cruise and diet. And you're going on a cruise, so see you later. They sent me out on the USS Enterprise that way, with low blood sugar and with valley fever. And when you do those drills, you got the steel part, this is done, the sleeves are buttoned, your pants are inside you, and there's no air conditioning because it's simulated chemical warfare. And that goes on for hours and hours and hours. I made it through that. So I was up in San Joaquin Valley. We had a meeting in town, like at a church like this, and there was no place to put the coffee pot. And I'm driving home after the meeting one night, and I heard this horn beeping. I look in my rearview mirror, and there's a cloud of dust behind me. There's a lot of farm equipment up there, you know. And, you know, I pull over, so this lady from the meeting pulls over. And she said, you know, because there's the meeting, and there's my town, and her town was in the middle. She said, would you like to stop by for coffee? I said, sure. So I stopped by her house for coffee, got to know her, played some board games with her 11-year-old son. The night progressed. The 11-year-old son went to bed. Later, so did we. And that's the lady I spent the next 28 years of my life with. She never did drink again, but cigarettes got her. I just want to make sure you enjoy your smoke break out there. My first sponsor, the guy that I told you about, the cash, selling cash registers, after they took his jar out and that, he passed from that too. I'm so grateful. After 40 years, I was able to quit smoking. I quit smoking before my wife. So anyway, we came down here, you know, to that sister that was in Garden Grove, and I lived in Lake Forest by El Toro High School. So we came down here. That was my only other relative on the West Coast. And we really liked it. We liked the area and all that. And when am I supposed to stop? Okay. In the neighborhood, I was one day they were plowing this field and they were putting a gas station up there. And so I go over there, you know, and I was still kind of scrambled with this PTSD from Vietnam. And I thought, wow, I wonder if I'd ever be able to work here. And the owner's hanging up belts and stuff. And he said, yeah, sure, you want to come to work? So he opened the station. I went to work for him and I worked for him for 20 years. And this couple, they had a bunch of kids, 8 kids. And we put a transmission in their van. And my boss says, they can't pay for this van in one lump sum, and they're making payments. And when they pick it up, I want this van running. So you need to use it once in a while to go get parts or take somebody home or whatever. So I said, okay, boss. So I walk up to this van, and there's a sticker on the rear window, something about the house in Cleveland. A house in Cleveland. I thought, that's strange. And another day, I go get in his van to run it, so it, and the directory falls out of the pouch, you know. That's my sponsor, Alice, and her husband. That's where I met him. And I met a lot of people in that station. People used to come in with the Easy Does It stickers. I have a little one on my car. And because I did a lot of rummage sales, car washes and stuff, at Oceanside, to save money, we were going to build a club. And I had to go to sea, but that if you look at San Luis Mission, off to the right in a standalone building, the Oceanside Club, that's the club that I helped to raise money to buy. When I was gone, that building came available, and they bought that. So when I went down to see that place 30 years later, that's why I bought that little Easy Does It sticker that I put on my car. And so it just reminded me where I came from. And so where was I? I had a. So I'm out on the aircraft carrier feeling like a dish rag all the time. And, you know, we went into foreign ports and all that stuff. And I made it through the cruise. That school that I told you that I washed out of, they teach you the exams. They literally teach you the exam, almost verbatim. So even through the drunken haze, I was able to absorb enough that when I took that next test, I passed it big time. And so, I was E6, sergeant, first class, whatever. And so I retained enough knowledge of that. And so Alice and Bill, with that van that we put the transmission, and Alice, my wife, was pretty sick. I was trying to work, keep the paychecks coming, and take care of her. I'd get up in the middle of the night, do breathing treatments, help her with the breathing treatments and all that stuff. And it was getting to be a struggle, and I wasn't doing many meetings, and Alice and Bill knew that, and they got me encouraged to go to more meetings. And after she passed, and of course I got real active, and I asked Alice to sponsor me. And Bill gave us permission to do that. We went to Toronto, Canada, to the International. We went to San Antonio, to the International. And the next International is going to be in Atlanta, Georgia, and they say the one after that is going to be in Detroit, Michigan. And International people come from all over the country. So I've always been involved, with somehow in the club. I've always had a commitment in AA and something beyond that. Right now I'm chairman of the El Toro Fellowship, Saddleback Valley Fellowship, commonly called the El Toro Club, even though it's in Mission Viejo now. I'm treasure of that right now. I've always had some kind of commitment. If I don't have a commitment, I make a commitment. I help with the chairs. What do you need done? Help with, because I want to feel a part of. What I understand about this disease, if I'm going to drink after 30 days, 30 minutes, or 30 years, the first thing I got to do is separate me from you. And I will do that by sex, by money, by age, by color, any way that I can separate me from you so that I can say, I'm not like those people, and go out that door and get a drink and die. So I try to stay connected. And so I was chairman. I was chairman of the club. And I used to go there. I work in the afternoon. So I would go by the club in the afternoon, usually in my uniform, make sure nothing got broke or stolen, enough cream and sugar, whatever. And then I'd go off to work at the hospital. Well, this tall, lean, mean Asian lady would be standing out there smoking. And I thought, wow. Because, I did Match.com and that stuff. I was a widow for 8 years. And I wanted no small children, speaks English, drives a car, and doesn't smoke. 2 out of 4. She got to me. 2 out of 4. Because I'd pull up there and she'd be out there smoking. And I talked. She'll tell you my pickup line. She was out there one day and I went over and slapped a cigarette out of her hand. And I said, I'll show you a picture of somebody who used to smoke. And it's my wife was as big as me, as tall as me. And she was like 89 pounds at the end. And I had a picture of that. And I showed her. So she tells everybody that was my pickup line, slapping a cigarette out of her hand. But anyway, we've been married 3.5 years. My wife was Filipino. So when we went to the International, they brought in the Filipino flag. We're all jumping and yelling. Her son, she raises a single mom. He's 23. He's coming. So it'll be the first time we'll have mom, dad, son. So newcomers, what I'm trying to say is I've made 2 complete families in Alcoholics Anonymous sober. They've never, not only never saw me drunk, they never saw me pick up a drink. In sobriety, I've made 2 complete families. If you don't drink, this what's going to open up to you is just unbelievable. If you're an alcoholic and you drink, it's clear you're going to the cemetery. If you're one of the lucky, fortunate ones, you're going to get to come back here one more time and say, I just got out of the jailhouse, I just got out of the nut house, Charlie Street, Ashland House, whatever. Stay here with us. Stay here with us. Hopefully she has the 20 questions. Answer those questions. Read the book. Read this literature and stuff and, see if you belong here. If you're just a heavy drinker, you can do a couple meetings and go about your business. But if you're an alcoholic, your life depends on this. 77 years, June 10th, I think it is, that AA's been going. Before that, people like us died. We died in jail. We died on the streets. We died in the nut houses. And, so, thank God for Bill and Bob. I did not intend to stay sober 41 years. I did not have pure motives like most people that come here. My idea was to get the Navy off my back and maybe get the stripe back that they took away at that court-martial. So if you knew or fairly new and you have a plan, do not exercise your plan. Tell us your plan. And if we laugh, it's probably because we had the same plan. The hook around here is laughter. If we can get you to laugh, we got you. Most of us get here not in very good laughter. If you watch the newcomers, they'll go, and then one day they laugh, and we got them. And we got them. That's the hook in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's not money, it's not fame, it's not whatever. All we want you to do is get sober and have the best life that you can possibly have. So I hope I hope I've helped somebody. And that's all. I said a little prayer before this, and that's all I wanted to do. Ask God, just help me to maybe touch somebody. And I've of the 11 siblings, 4 of them are confirmed with Alzheimer's. I just signed up at UCI for the memory program. I'm doing okay, I think. But anyway, I want to be in the pipeline as they come out with new medications and stuff like that. And so stay connected. Stay connected, newcomers, and do whatever you have to do to feel like you belong here. If you're like most of us, you've really worked for that seat. Don't give it up. If somebody else comes in, we'll get another chair. Don't give up your seat for anything or anybody. After I married that gal, the first wife, I started doing Al-Anon. So I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in 1971 because the Navy turned me into a counselor, and they said, we want you to go to Al-Anon and see what this is about because you're going to be sending people there. And so when I decided to marry this gal, I literally had to go to her sponsor and get permission and all that stuff. And that's when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting for me. And so I've been, you know, active in Al-Anon, active in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I can't think of a whole lot more to say. It's just, it's extremely important that you find out if you're an alcoholic. We get a lot of young people in here, they want to identify as addicts. They want to try to preserve their right to drink alcohol. And that can kill you. That can kill you. In some meetings, they'll let you do that, and that's not right. And so, I was only 30 years old when I got sober. I didn't realize what I did. When I was 60 years old, I was 30 years sober, and some young people came up to me, and they said, we're going to beat your record. And I go, what are you talking about? They said, well, I came in at 20. I can be 40 when I hit the halfway mark. I can beat your record. I said, fine, we all do it one day at a time. If that's what you want for a long-term goal, go for it. So I wish you the best, newcomers, and stay here with us. It's the alternative. Is that other stuff is it isn't necessary. And that's it. I'm just babbling now. Thank you.